Welcome to a special edition of Oncology Today, updates of a CME program on prostate cancer management held at the 2024 GU Cancer Symposium. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Emmanuel Antonarakis from the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to discuss his perspectives on several key issues discussed at the CME Symposium. To begin, he reflected on some of the key trends in clinical research and management of prostate cancer over the last 10 years.
You know, we've had a love-hate relationship with ADT, whether it should be done early, whether it should be done late, whether it should be augmented, whether it should be discontinued in certain patients. So that debate still remains. We've had big changes in the use of genetics and genomics. 10 years ago, we weren't talking about that for almost any cancer except for perhaps breast cancer. Now it's being discussed in prostate cancer. And the third big difference is the use of these PSMA next generation imaging agents, which have changed what we used to call biochemical recurrence into what we are now calling oligometastatic PSMA detected prostate cancer. So the field is changing fast. We have new molecular therapeutics. We have new classes of drugs called radioligand therapies, radiopharmaceuticals that target PSMA. We also have PARP inhibitors that have been borrowed from breast cancer into prostate cancer.
I mean, the other thing we have is a lot of clinical trial data, big phase three trials that people said, you know, we'd never be able to do, even, you know, looking at PSMA recurrence at Hopkins, where you were before, where you are now, we took such a leadership role. We had to use historical data, et cetera. And boom, all of a sudden, you know, we out there in the field are seeing these huge phase three industry supported trials. Any thoughts about that?
You know, we're seeing two types of phase threes. We're seeing the industry supported trials. Of course, those make an impact, including EMBARK, which changed everything, turned it upside down with the biochemical recurrence space. We used to say no hormone therapy is one standard of care, and now we are rethinking that. But I also want to give credit to some of the cooperative groups, the UK Stampede study, and also the French and European PEACE 1 study, because we're seeing an equal number of investigator-initiated phase threes, which I think, Neil, is even more impressive than the industry phase threes. I think they're both playing a role.
Can you just comment briefly on the Stampede effort? It's really an interesting story how it evolved. Can you talk a little bit about what they did there?
Yeah, the Stampede study was done in a country, in a health system, where you wanted to maximize resources and minimize waste and minimize duplication of patients and resources. So what they decided to do was create a study that had 8 arms. I used to call it the octopus trial. Now it has, I think, 12 arms. But when it was first conceived, it was conceived with a rolling control arm. And the rolling control arm means that the control arm may change over time as the standard of care evolves. So the control arm initially, as you might recall, was ADT alone. And then there were 2 data sets, one showing that ADT plus 6 cycles of docetaxel improved survival, then a second showing that ADT plus abiraterone improved survival. And over time, the control arm of the Stampede study changed because it was no longer clinically ethical or appropriate just to offer ADT alone. It changed to involve ADT docetaxel or ADT plus abiraterone. And then other hypotheses were asked along the way, such as, does a treatment of the primary prostate gland improve survival? That was the arm H. And then, you know, does abiraterone plus enzalutamide as a combo improve survival over one of those alone? And there are new arms now with PARP inhibitors, which have not reported yet. So it's a good way to conduct 8 trials in one, let's say, or 10 trials in one, where you are using the same control arm and not having to use multiple trials with different control arms.
One other thing you mentioned that just had such a gigantic effect that you alluded to was the evolution of imaging, particularly the PSMA scan. And now we're seeing people who are having disease identified that's not seen on conventional imaging. It was never done with all the trials that we're looking at right now, so nobody knows how to apply it or theoretically or even practically, you know, one of the things that I have heard people talk about is finding patients with oligometastatic disease and how that, you know, kind of changes the equation and allows the opportunity for maybe local therapy rather than systemic therapy. Right now, I mean, nobody really knows the answer, but what are you yourself doing in terms of sort of factoring in PSMA scan results?
Yeah, this is an example where the technology has outpaced the evidence, the clinical evidence, that is. There was one large study which was called the COMET SABER trial, COMET hyphen SABR. And that was with multiple tumor types, not just prostate. In fact, prostate was the minority in that trial. And that trial showed that when you radiate oligometastatic disease across a variety of cancer types, you might improve survival. There were then two prostate cancer specific studies to test the hypothesis. One was called the Oriole study, coming from Baltimore, the Baltimore Orioles, and the second called the STOMP study, done in Europe and Belgium. And those two studies, the Oriole and the STOMP study, they were not powered to look for overall survival, but it's the data that we have, and it's imperfect. But in my practice, Neil, when I have a patient with what we used to call biochemical recurrence of prostate cancer, in other words, they've had a radical prostatectomy in the past, their PSA is rising, or they've had radiotherapy as their primary treatment and their PSA is rising, or the combination of primary prostatectomy followed by adjuvant or salvage radiotherapy and the PSA is rising, when I see a patient with a PSA above 0.2, 2/10 of a point, especially if it's between 0.2 and 0.5, I will offer that patient a PSMA PET scan. And if I don't see metastatic disease, I may not necessarily jump right into ADT plus or minus enzalutamide, according to the EMBARK study. But if I do see oligometastatic disease, especially if it's three or fewer metastases, then I have the following discussion with the patient. I either tell him that we can send you for a stereotactic radiotherapy in an effort to avoid the initiation of ADT, or in patients who may wish to be a little bit more aggressive, I offer them the stereotactic radiotherapy plus a short course of finite ADT, for example, 6 months, and then stopping.
Okay, well, maybe we can start to go through some of the specific scenarios we talked about in the meeting. Let's get down, talk about non-metastatic disease, which is the first topic we talked about. And of course, the STAMPEDE data and the STAMPEDE trial was a big issue here. So can you talk a little bit about what they have seen in some of their studies and other studies of localized disease, high-risk disease, locally advanced disease, and how, endocrine intensification has worked its way all the way down, starting at, hormone-sensitive mets through PSA only down to the local setting. Where are we today here in general? And also, one of the questions Andy Armstrong asked was, are there situations where you're comfortable substituting another AR pathway inhibitor for abiraterone, which was looked at in the STAMPEDE trial? And also some thoughts about what are some of the strategies that are being looked at right now in these patients in clinical trials.
A lot of questions there, Neil. The STAMPEDE study, one of the publications was the so-called M0 cohort. It's also called STAMPEDE M0 sometimes. And these were patients that primarily had a non-metastatic new diagnosis of localized or locally advanced prostate cancers. And they had to have particularly high-risk features. And there were three high-risk features, and you had to have not just one of the three, but you had to have two of the three. And the high-risk features was either Gleason score 8, 9, or 10, or PSA above 40, 4-0, or radiographic positive nodes, pelvic nodes. And again, remember that a Gleason score of 9 alone is not enough. PSA of 45 is not enough, and one disease is not enough. You had to have two of those three or three of those three. And then those patients were randomized to receive either ADT alone or ADT plus abiraterone. And then there was another sub-study that did not receive much attention, where they got the triplet, ADT plus abiraterone plus enzalutamide. And the abiraterone plus enzalutamide was presented in the same paper as the abiraterone alone, and they did not see a benefit of the triplet versus the doublet, but they did see a very, very clear benefit, not just in metastasis-free survival, which was sort of expected, but the unexpected piece was a benefit in overall survival. So what that means now for us in the clinic is if we have a patient with newly diagnosed, what I would call ultra-high risk localized prostate cancer or locally advanced prostate cancer with pelvic node disease, but nothing beyond that, if the patient is fit and has a projected lifespan of at least 3-4 years, we should be considering the combination of ADT plus abiraterone. Now, there's two important things about the abiraterone. The duration of the abiraterone is not infinite. It's 2 years. So 2 years of ABI, even though the ADT might be continued longer than that, and sometimes it was lifelong in the trial. And the second is that in that setting, the prednisone dose could be 5 milligrams once a day. It didn't have to be 5 milligrams twice a day. So we are minimizing the chronic steroid exposure in these patients. Now, 4% of patients on that trial had a biochemical recurrence. It was a tiny amount. And because those 4% with biochemical recurrence were also allowed in the Stampede M0, some people have extrapolated, and I am not one of those people, some people have extrapolated saying that if someone has a very high-risk biochemical recurrence after initial local therapy, that those patients can also get, at the time of BCR, ADT plus abiraterone. I don't think the data there is that strong because that 4% subset was tiny, it was underpowered. And also now we have the EMBARK study, which we'll get to in a second, which I think the level of evidence is much, much higher. So I typically do not endorse the use of abiraterone plus ADT in the biochemical recurrence setting, Neil, but I do endorse it in patients that have high-risk localized disease with two or more of the high-risk features.
What about patients who initially have prostatectomy, have biochemical recurrence, and get salvage pelvic radiation? Do you have data on that, intensifying that ADT?
Yeah, you know, there's some data there with respect to the duration of the ADT. There is much less data there with the intensification. I believe there was a trial that was presented by Paul Wen from Dana-Farber. They were using a drug that used to be called ARN-509, which is now apalutamide. And they looked at 6 months of ADT plus abiraterone plus or minus apalutamide. And they did show an improvement in a PSA recurrence-free survival. I do not believe that trial was powered for overall survival. So in general, in the salvage RT setting, most people, including myself, we do believe that there's a role for ADT because we do think that it synergizes. It accentuates the cell killing, the radiotherapy induced cell killing. And we typically limit that to 6 months. And we like to start that 1 to 2 months before the salvage radiotherapy. And then the salvage radiotherapy itself takes about 7 weeks. So we continue the ADT through the salvage and then for about 2 months afterwards, and then we stop.
Do you sort of buy into the concept, and which is pretty similar to the way I think they think it through in breast cancer, that in general, whenever you intensify hormonal therapy of prostate cancer, say beyond ADT, you're going to get an additional benefit, whether or not you do it or not, or it's justified based on risk benefit is another question. But theoretically, at least in breast cancer, that's the model that they sort of subscribe to. And then depending upon what the risk is, they may not intensify because it may not be worth it. But still, theoretically, they believe that the risk of recurrence or disease progression or whatever is going to be lower in general. And that in prostate cancer, kind of the earlier you intensify, the greater impact you see on survival?
I think in prostate cancer, the picture is not as clear. And, you know, whenever you you give systemic therapy along with adjuvant or salvage therapy, there are two hypotheses. One hypothesis is that it will make the adjuvant or salvage radiotherapy more effective. The second hypothesis is that you are eliminating micrometastatic disease. I think most of the data in prostate cancer supports that the intensification of ADT plus, you know, ARPI is better at eradicating micrometastatic disease. I don't think we have enough evidence, or at least I don't buy that argument, that it makes the radiotherapy more effective and more likely to cure the patient.
So let's talk about what I labeled last year as the number one trial of 2023 in oncology, not prostate cancer, in oncology, the study that just completely blew my mind, and I think probably a whole lot of other people, the EMBARK trial. EMBARK was a little bit, or I would say a lot more complicated, and it really also put a strong light on the issue of intermittent therapy. And all of a sudden, enzalutamide monotherapy, just stunning set of data that continues to evolve. First of all, can you kind of summarize, you know, kind of what they did there and kind of what your take was on it?
Yeah, so, you know, the investigators ventured to do a trial in a space that, no one had done it before. So it was very brave. It took about 10 years to get the answer. So we'll talk about how the landscape changed over those 10 years. But this was in the pre-PSMA era, where we only had conventional CT scans, conventional technetium-99 bone scans. And these were patients that had a radical prostatectomy with or without salvage or adjuvant radiotherapy. And they had to have a rising PSA level. Their absolute PSA level had to be a minimum of 1.0. nanograms per deciliter, and they had to be at high risk of metastases. And this is important, Neil, because not every biochemical recurrent patient has life-threatening disease, and they defined this as a PSA doubling time less than 9 months. So it was a combination of an absolute PSA having to be above 1.0 and a rapid PSA doubling time. And if you look at the natural history of prostate cancer by the Hopkins series and other series as well, about 30 to 40% of biochemical recurrent patients fit in this high-risk group, and about 60% are in the much, much lower risk group. And the population that EMBARK did not address are the patients in the low risk of metastases. So we should not be using EMBARK to make decisions on patients that have PSA doubling time of 3 years with an absolute PSA of 0.5. That was not the population. Now, let's go back to the EMBARK trial. So rapid PSA doubling time, PSA above 1.0, they had to have negative conventional imaging. They did not undergo PSMA scans, negative CT scan, negative bone scan. They were then randomized to one of three arms. The control arm was leuprolide alone. The first interventional arm was leuprolide plus enzalutamide. And then the third arm, which was the surprising one, was enzalutamide monotherapy without the ADT. And the design was very unique. In all three arms, they treated patients for a total of 9 months. After the 9th month, if the PSA level had dropped down to less than 0.2, the patient was given the option of discontinuing the treatment, all systemic treatment. And then patients were monitored for PSA recurrence in that scenario. And if the PSA level rose above 2, they were then restarted on the same arm that they had been initially randomized to. And after restarting, they were not given the chance for a second interruption. They had to then continue permanently. The primary endpoint of the trial was metastasis-free survival. The key secondary endpoint was overall survival. The statistical plan was only going to compare the ADT plus enzalutamide versus ADT alone. So even though there was a third arm with the ENZA monotherapy, and even though there were some statistics presented, that was not how the study was powered. So that was sort of an exploratory subset, although maybe the most clinically interesting subset. And the metastasis-free survival was statistically and clinically improved in the enzalutamide plus ADT arm above ADT alone. And then the provocative part was that even though the study was not powered to look at the ENZA monotherapy, even the ENZA monotherapy improved metastasis-free survival with respect to leuprolide monotherapy. Now, none of the overall survival results are mature. The overall survival is trending in the direction of a benefit in the ADT plus enzalutamide group versus ADT alone. And there's also a trend, although a more modest trend, in the enzalutamide monotherapy also. But we can't at this point make definitive statements about whether this improves survival, but it definitely improves metastasis-free survival.
So from my point of view, first of all, I was, like everybody, I was fascinated by the enzalutamide monotherapy. You know, we actually started our work in CME and prostate cancer in about the year 2000 when there was this gigantic adjuvant bicalutamide study. It was the biggest study in the history of oncology. Even now, I think it was like 9,000 people. They got a lot of low risk people and it didn't work out, et cetera. But it was, monotherapy. They had to deal with gynecomastia and the issue of preventive radiation. So that really leads to one of the major questions, I think, that came out of EMBARK that I'm not sure I know the exact answer of, which is how would you compare quality of life, tolerability, side effects, enzalutamide monotherapy to ADT either alone or with enzalutamide? Sexuality, sexual function, gynecomastia, everything.
Yeah, this came up, during the ASCO GU session, and I think that there was some division here amongst the faculty members. Yep. The perception by patients and by many oncologists prior to this study being done was that enzalutamide monotherapy or bicalutamide monotherapy, for that matter, as you mentioned, may preserve erectile function and sexual desire, libido, at the expense of gynecomastia, breast tenderness, and enlargement. And what we did see in the EMBARK study in the enzalutamide monotherapy arm was a very high rate of 40% or 45% gynecomastia, which was bothersome to patients. What we did not see as much, Neil, and this was the part that was surprising to me. You know, I started to practice after the bicalutamide monotherapy era, so I didn't have a personal experience with that myself. But while there was some remnant of sexual desire and function, it was clearly suppressed, even with the enzalutamide. But perhaps the sexual function was at an intermediate stage, which was worse than when the enzalutamide was not used, but better than it would have been if the leuprolide was used.
So, in a way, sometimes I think about enzalutamide and the similar AR blockers sort of like tamoxifen. Am I correct in saying the testosterone level actually goes up?
Testosterone goes up, and then there is peripheral aromatization into estrogens, which is what causes the gynecomastia.
And then the other thing I have heard is that one dose of radiation therapy generally prevents the gynecomastia very effectively without any issues.
Yes. If you speak with radiation oncologists, they will tell you very confidently that between one and up to three doses of nipple and breast radiotherapy prior to beginning the anti-androgen monotherapy prevents the growth of the breast tissue. It does not necessarily prevent that nipple sensitivity and nipple tenderness. So that remains, but the actual increase in the breast tissue itself can be largely, although not totally, prevented.
So I want to just sort of close this section with a couple of questions about the survey that we did of the faculty, including you, and then we'll go on to hormone sensitive metastatic disease. So one thing we asked everybody was, tell us about the last patient in your practice with locally advanced prostate cancer. And you said you had a 58-year-old man, PSA of 19, Gleason 5 plus 4 equals 9, CT3B, no negative, PSA PET negative, got ADT plus abiraterone for 2 years, primary prostatic radiation therapy. Kind of lines up with what you just said very well. Anything you want to say about that case?
Whenever I have a man who's younger than 60, which of course is quite unusual with prostate cancer, you know, median age is about 70 to 72, alarm bells are going off in my head. The other thing, Neil, is Gleason score 9, we worry about that. But what we really worry about is when that 5 goes in front of the 4. So when it's a 5 plus 4, pathologists call that primary pattern 5. Huh. And primary pattern 5 means that there is a higher abundance of pattern 5 versus pattern 4. It can be, you know, 80% pattern 5, 20% pattern 4, or it can be 51% pattern 5, 49% pattern 4. Those patients behave more aggressively than those that have a 4 plus 5 equals 9. And so whenever I see a 5 plus 4 instead of a 4 plus 5, I think of that as a Gleason 10. And by the way, those patients have very interesting molecular genetics. They have a much higher risk of having a homologous recombination mutation like BRCA2. They also have a higher risk of MSI high disease and microsatellite instability, which is relevant with the use of pembrolizumab and PD-1 inhibitors. But unfortunately, they also have a much greater chance of being androgen insensitive and therefore becoming castration resistant more quickly. So for all those reasons, I would almost always, unless the patient had a very low life expectancy, treat that man with ADT plus abiraterone. The abiraterone will be for 2 years, and then I will typically stop that and continue the ADT.
So we also were talking about the biochemical recurrence. We asked people, who was the last patient who got systemic therapy for biochemical recurrence, keeping in mind what you were saying is that a lot of people don't need therapy because they're not high risk. The patient you talked about, though, was 62, PSA 1.8, a PSA doubling time 5.5 months, got leuprolide, ANZA 160, planned at 12 months if a complete PSA response, and I guess intermittent a la EMBARK.
Yeah, you know, for me, if I have a PSA doubling time less than 6 months, those patients have a natural history of metastasis-free survival of 1 to 2 years. So those guys will definitely develop a metastasis quickly. And also if the PSA is above 1. So in this case, PSA was well above 1. The man was on the younger side. He had a very rapid PSA doubling time, and I went with a combination.
So last question, then we'll move on. This is one of the most interesting ones, which is, do you bring up enzalutamide monotherapy without ADT as an option to your patients with a biochemical recurrence? You have the interesting answer of yes if the patient asks. What happened with this patient?
Yeah, the other way of answering that is to say that I typically don't bring it up unless the unless the patient brings it up. And, and patients bring it up about 10% of the time. It doesn't happen too often, but every once in a while you'll have a patient who has read about the EMBARK study, has seen that third arm, or they just ask, can I get the pill without the injections? Some people are phobic of injectable treatments. And again, if my patient asks, then I will very transparently discuss that with them. I will tell them that it does not appear to be as effective as the ADT plus the enzalutamide in terms of metastasis-free survival, although those two arms were not compared directly to each other. They were each compared against the control arm. And what I will definitely tell them is that you have a high risk of getting gynecomastia, which I describe as female breast tissue sometimes. There are patients that are dissuaded by that. But there are some men, Neil, who are so intent on maintaining their erectile and sexual function that they will want to go with the enzalutamide monotherapy. And I've done it twice, you know, since the EMBARK study was published, which is not super frequent, but, you know, I have done it.
How do those patients do quality of life wise?
You know, in one of those two cases, the patient asked me what can be done to mitigate the gynecomastia. I did refer him for the breast radiotherapy, and he actually did very well. He lost some sexual function, but was still able to penetrate and have some degree of erections. He did not get the gynecomastia. The other gentleman, I decided to just treat him, you know, and see what happens. And he did develop the gynecomastia. It took about 6 months for that to kick in. But then between the 6th month and 9th month, it was so bothersome that he actually asked me to add the leuprolide. And ironically, when we added the leuprolide, we were now suppressing LHRH. The gynecomastia stabilized. It did not get better, but it stopped getting worse.
So it's interesting that, you know, you're not presenting, at least as an option, a therapy that seems to be you know, I guess you can argue about this, at least as good and probably better than what we've been using the last 20 years, which is ADT.
You know, Neil, it's a fair comment, and I love that you're challenging me. If we see a mature overall survival, which should be coming in the next 1 to 2 years, and if the overall survival at the final analysis does show a significant survival benefit with enza monotherapy, that for me would tip the balance, and that would be the point where I would actually start actively mentioning that option to patients.
One final question, which is, any comments about the PRESTO phase 3 study with apalutamide? It seems like it's not as mature, but how would you compare it to EMBARK, and do you see apalutamide kind of entering this space in some point?
I don't yet. PRESTO did not aim to investigate metastasis-free or overall survival. It was really looking at time to subsequent PSA recurrence. So it was a PSA recurrence-free survival primary endpoint. Three arms in that study as well. And the doublet arm was better than the single in terms of PSA progression-free survival, but the triplet arm was not better than the doublet. Because the trial was not powered for clinically meaningful endpoints like metastasis or survival, I don't think that this will be endorsed by the NCCN guidelines or other guidelines. And I don't think it's practice changing, although it does prove the principle that augmenting the anti-androgen therapy in that setting may be beneficial.
One more thing I was just curious about, as we're talking about hormonal therapy intensification, and you can imagine what it's like in breast cancer nowadays. I mean, we're spending 2 whole hours on it, just on what's going on in endocrine intensification in a few weeks. And I am seeing a lot of cool things going on in prostate too. It seems to be a little bit earlier. First of all, any comments on CDK and abemaciclib? I saw there was a negative press release out there. Does that mean it's over? Are there other trials out there? What do you think about the degraders and, you know, next steps in terms of hormonal therapy of prostate cancer?
I think the CDK4/6 inhibitors has been disappointing in prostate cancer. There were a few small phase 2 studies, some of which I participated in, with palbociclib and then ribociclib, and then, of course, the phase 3s with abemaciclib. The press release was in the metastatic castration-resistant setting where abemaciclib did not appear to improve outcomes above and beyond abiraterone alone, so it was abiraterone plus or minus abemaciclib. I do believe, Neil, that this story will be closed, the chapter will be closed in prostate cancer. There are a lot of similarities between breast and prostate, and this is probably one of the differences where we don't see an improvement. The androgen receptor remains a very important and powerful target in this disease, despite abiraterone, enzalutamide, and darolutamide. And the greatest evidence of that is that PSA itself, which is a gene that is driven by the androgen receptor, often goes up at the end of life and in patients who have progressed on abienza and darolutamide. So we know that the AR itself remains active. And there are some ways to try to block it. One is to degrade the androgen receptor protein with these so-called proteolytic chimeras, also called PROTACs. Dan Petrylak has been involved in one of those, and they are moving into phase 2 and phase 3 studies shortly, based on some preliminary activity in phase 2. And then there's another approach, which is a drug that's called ODM-208, which is a drug that inhibits the adrenal enzyme called cytochrome P11, CYP11. Not to be confused with CYP17, which is a target of abiraterone. CYP11 is a much more proximal upstream enzyme that converts cholesterol, which is the very, very first building block of all the steroid hormones, including the androgens and the estrogens, cholesterol to pregnenolone. And CYP11, if you block CYP11 with the drugs such as ODM-208, you not only knock out androgen production, you also knock out glucocorticoid production and mineralocorticoid production. So those patients need aldosterone supplementation and dexamethasone supplementation. But the phase two study, which has been published in a new journal called NEJM Evidence, Karim Fizazi was the first author, shows interesting clinical activity of that drug, especially in patients that have activating mutations in the androgen receptor. So similar to these ESR1 mutations in breast cancer, which activate the estrogen receptor, we have activating mutations in the AR, which activate the androgen receptor. And it's those patients that appear to benefit the most from both the PROTAC degraders that we talked about just a moment ago, and this CYP11 inhibitor.
So let's talk a little bit about hormone-sensitive metastatic disease. You actually did the presentation at the meeting that reviewed the data, and I think we really went through that very well. I guess a couple of questions, though, in terms of sort of, like I said, how I do it, so to speak. I'm curious how you approach hormone-sensitive metastatic disease right now outside a clinical trial setting. And I guess a couple of the questions I have of greatest interest are, first of all, how do you go back choosing a endocrine partner with ADT? And in what patients do you think about docetaxel?
Yeah, so the most important learning point or teaching point for community oncologists is that a doublet that contains only ADT plus docetaxel is no longer sufficient. We were doing that for many years based on the charted study from Chris Sweeney and the Stampede study. And we now know that when you use ADT docetaxel as a backbone and you either add abiraterone or darolutamide, the triplet is better than the doublet. So ADT plus docetaxel alone without the third agent should no longer be done. So the first thing that I ask myself when I have a patient with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer is the patient fit enough for six cycles of docetaxel chemotherapy? And if the answer is yes, I always discuss docetaxel with them. Now, if you're fit enough for it, then there is still a greater relative benefit if the prostate cancer is de novo, meaning that it has popped up out of the blue, rather than prostate cancer that was localized, treated, and then subsequently recurred many years later. That's called metachronous. So the de novo ones are the ones that present stage four disease out of the blue, no prior history. So the benefit of triplet is higher for those patients. And then the benefit of triplet may also be higher, potentially, although this is less clear, in patients that have the high volume metastatic disease defined as more than four bone metastases or a visceral metastasis. But I think of it first as, are they chemo fit or not? And then secondly, if they're chemo fit, is this the patient that would derive the greatest benefit? But I also don't think that a young man with a high Gleason score who might have three metastases, I'm not sure if that patient shouldn't receive chemotherapy. I think that what you can tell that man is the relative benefit might be a little bit lower because you have fewer metastases, but you're still likely to benefit. So if the patient is not chemo fit, then they should be receiving a doublet. They should not be receiving ADT alone. So that's the second key point. And there, the decision is between ADT plus abiraterone or ADT plus enzalutamide. At the current time, if you're going to go by the guidelines, you cannot just give ADT plus darolutamide in that patient because the darolutamide has only been approved in that setting as part of the triplet that contains chemotherapy. A controversial question, you know, would be, would you ever prescribe ADT plus darolutamide without giving the chemo? And some people do that. That's not how the Arisense study was designed. And there is an ongoing study that has completed enrollment outside the U.S. where they compared ADT plus darolutamide alone, no chemo in that study, but we have to wait for those results. And the antiandrogen is selected based on patient preference, comorbidities, and other contraindications.
Let me just challenge you a little bit. You know, there are two things that I don't know, somehow I just always see differently than GU oncologists. One is the EMBARK stuff. You know, I don't know, for some reason I see that monotherapy differently in the UL. But the other is kind of this. is docetaxel, because as I think Raina pointed out in the video we showed there, obviously there is no data showing that you get anything by adding docetaxel to intensified, you know, therapy with ADT plus a novel agent. I can sort of understand clinically, totally, particularly, you know, higher risk, younger, you're going to get it anyhow. Maybe you might go through it now, totally clinically, but just keep in mind, and maybe even bring it up to the patient, that we really don't know that it's better than waiting.
Yes, Neil, you know, that has always bothered me as well. And at the time that the trials were designed, the standard of care was ADT docetaxel. There is a cooperative group study that is being designed to answer that question. In other words, whether the docetaxel as the third component adds anything above and beyond ADT plus an antiandrogen, that will be 3-4 years before we get an answer on that. And in the meantime, I do agree with you. I often do discuss with patients that we do not have unequivocal evidence that there's anything better than ADT plus one of the novel hormone therapies. Now, I have found that there are certain biological or genetic considerations, which, again, I cannot prove that this is helping the patient, but I can extrapolate it from other scenarios. For example, we have very good evidence from the castration-resistant population that patients that have P53 mutations or patients that have RB1 mutations or loss or patients that have P10 mutations or loss, those patients are more prone to developing hormone therapy resistance. Especially when I see a patient that has two out of those three, which we sometimes call the double tumor suppressor loss. And again, if that patient is chemo fit, again, without having any definitive evidence yet, I think that evidence will be coming in the forthcoming years, I do like to consider chemotherapy in those patients. But at the current time, if a practitioner in the community or elsewhere wants to use ADT plus ABI or ADT plus ENZA alone and really doesn't feel that there's compelling evidence to add the docetaxel, he or she would be correct.
So two quick questions. I hesitate to ask this because I want to try to get through this, but I just have to. One is, with the existence of PSA, is there any potential role of cell-free DNA in prostate cancer? And the other question is, have any ADCs to PSMA been done?
You know, the cell-free DNA is used in prostate cancer. It's not used to track minimal residual disease in the same way that it is in other cancers. It is used to genomically characterize the cancer when a bone biopsy is not feasible. So the antibody drug conjugate story has been a bit disappointing so far because of the toxicity of the payloads. And right. A few years ago, we did a number of PSMA targeting antibody drug conjugates. They caused peripheral neuropathies and myopathies. I had one patient, Neil, who became wheelchair bound. It never returned. Now, there is a new target where the ADCs appear to be effective and less toxic, and it's B7H3. And, yeah. And there are a bunch of B7H3 antibody drug conjugates in metastatic prostate cancer, one of which I've worked with extensively. And we are seeing, you know, PSA response rates in the 50% level, objective response rates in the 25% level with acceptable, although not perfect, toxicity. And I think that will be the future for ADCs, in my opinion, B7H3 targeting ADC rather than PSMA ADCs.
All right, let's talk about PARP inhibitors, certainly an area you've been very, very involved with. And maybe just to comment a little bit on where we are today in terms of genomic evaluation of patients, when they should be evaluated, how they should be evaluated, and how you take that information and bring it into clinical decision-making.
So there's two aspects with genomics. One is the germline inherited risk, and the second is the tumor genomics, which we sometimes call the somatic DNA. And I think at this point in time, Neil, most academic prostate cancer oncologists, including me, would argue that the germline and somatic analysis should be done at the very first time you meet the patient, especially the very first time you meet a metastatic prostate cancer patient. It could be argued that for the non-metastatic, the germline is still necessary, but the somatic may not have any actionability. The germline testing can be done by a saliva test or a blood test, so that's easy. There's really nothing stopping us. Most insurance companies are approving and reimbursing those. And the somatic piece is, for metastatic patients, I like to do it before they become castration resistant, so I can plan for that next step. If I wait until they're castration resistant and then I get a castration resistant biopsy to look for the BRCA2, I feel like I'm losing some time, because again, that's the scenario where the combination of PARP inhibitor plus ARSI could be utilized, or PARP inhibitor alone. And I'd like to know that while they're still in the hormone sensitive state, so I can deploy that more quickly and nimbly as soon as they become CRPC.
So actually, when you mentioned BRCA, it sort of triggered something in me that I heard from Andy Armstrong when I was working with him to prepare for the meeting, which surprised me and almost kind of shocked me, which was, he said, and I had not heard, I knew that BRCA2 is much more common in prostate cancer, but what he was saying was that you hardly ever see BRCA1, and when he sees BRCA1, he checks it to make sure it's right, and that it's really all about BRCA2. It's not, and breast and ovary and all, you know, they're pretty similar, but is that right? Is it really pretty much all about BRCA2?
It's pretty much right. So there's two interesting things about that, and I don't want to get too off topic. In every other cancer that you mentioned, breast, ovarian, even pancreatic, it's a 50-50 split between BRCA1 and BRCA2. In prostate cancer, it's like a 9-to-1 ratio, where it's 9 times more common to have BRCA2 than BRCA1. The second interesting thing is that we don't know if germline BRCA1 mutations predisposed to prostate cancer. There's very clear evidence that germline BRCA1 mutations predisposed to breast cancer, ovarian cancer. But a lot of the prostate cancers that occur in germline BRCA1 carriers are sporadic cancers, meaning that the germline mutation had nothing to do with their prostate cancer.
And do we know whether or not PARP inhibitors are as effective in BRCA1 as BRCA2?
It has been studied, and the responses are much more modest in BRCA1.
And then in terms, you mentioned the combinations, now you have three of them approved. Can you talk about the supporting data for that strategy, and in your own practice, how you implement it?
In my opinion, the olaparib abiraterone has better safety and efficacy data than niraparib abiraterone. So I don't think the niraparib abi will be used as much, in my opinion. And then we have the talazoparib enzalutamide. So the two winners in my mind are abiraterone, olaparib, or talazoparib enzalutamide. And it will depend on whether the patient has received any of the agents previously in the hormone sensitive setting. If they have only received ADT or ADT plus docetaxel, but not one of the ARSIs, then both options are available. If a patient has received abiraterone as part of their hormone sensitive state, then I will offer that patient enzalutamide plus talazoparib. And if the patient has received enzalutamide as part of their hormone sensitive state, I may offer that patient abiraterone plus olaparib. The key thing here is that even though those studies were done with genomically unselected populations as well as HRR mutant populations, the FDA labels for both are only for the homologous recombination mutant in the case of talazoparib enzalutamide, or more specifically BRCA1 and BRCA2 for the abiraterone olaparib population. Now in Europe, as you may remember, the European Medicines Agency's EMA did approve the combos for all patients, but I don't think that in the US this will be widely done.
And I take it that there's maybe not a lot of enthusiasm among investigators to treating these patients who are not, who are HR proficient?
There's much less enthusiasm. The toxicity of combining PARP inhibitor plus an androgen receptor inhibitor is fairly significant, especially with respect to myelosuppression. And in particular with talazoparib, grade 3 or grade 4 anemia, which is, you know, requiring transfusions, it's pretty high, higher than 30%. And less so with olaparib abiraterone, but even there it was 15 to 20%, you know, transfusion requirements, at least one transfusion. Thrombocytopenia can be an issue. And then there is this, there's this lingering nausea, anorexia, which can be very troublesome to patients over time, and it can lead in some cases to weight loss, actually. And if the goal of therapy is to maintain the dose at the full dose of both agents, then it's hard to do, and it's harder to justify when a patient has a known wild type genetic status.
So, you know, one thing I've been curious about with PARP inhibitors in prostate cancer ever since I first started hearing about it is what the cytopenias would look like because of the fact that, you know, these patients a lot of times have a lot of bone disease. And initially I was hearing, you know, maybe it's not that much different than what you see in, you know, for example, breast or ovary. It kind of sounds like now you're describing a little bit more cytopenias than what you see in these other situations. And how do you deal with that? You know, one of the things we see in these other cancers is maybe not enough attention on dose reduction. How do you incorporate dose reduction in the management of these patients?
Yes. So one aspect is that prostate cancer is a bone tropic disease, and the bone marrow is the cause of the cytopenias for many of these patients before they get treatment with a PARP inhibitor. In the older days, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we often would delay a PARP inhibitor until after a taxane as well. So they had two reasons for cytopenias. One is the bone marrow itself having cancer in it. The second is they had received one or more prior chemotherapies. But there's also, in my mind, an exacerbation of cytopenias when you combine, and I don't know what the mechanism is, when you combine a PARP inhibitor plus an AR signaling inhibitor. It's not a doubling, but it's a slight numerical increase. So there is something about the synergy of those two agents that does increase at least anemia in my experience. What I like to do, Neil, is I like to reduce the dose and try to continue it rather than to interrupt and then go back to the same level. So if I'm prescribing olaparib, for example, either by itself or with abiraterone, I start with the 300 milligram BID dose, the full dose. And then if I see a grade 2 or a grade 3 anemia, for example, especially if the patient requires a transfusion, I like to reduce to 250 BID or 200 BID rather than stop for 2 weeks and then restart at the full dose, because if we do that, cytopenia returns.
Let's talk about radionuclide therapy and radiopharmaceuticals. Can you talk a little bit, first of all, about how you think through the use of lutetium in your practice now, even compared to, say, a year ago, and what the data is that you think about when you consider this drug and how you utilize it in your practice?
Yeah, so the VISION trial was the one that Oliver ran and was published in the New England Journal and led to the FDA approval of lutetium 177 PSMA. In that trial, patients in the control arm received what was called best supportive care. And best supportive care allowed antiandrogens like, you know, going to the alternative Aburenza, but it did not allow chemotherapy such as cabazitaxel. And, you know, that was always considered problematic in the U.S. because cabazitaxel would have been a treatment option for patients that have progressed after one hormone therapy and one chemotherapy. Now, there was an Australian study which compared lutetium PSMA to cabazitaxel. And that study showed a progression-free survival advantage of lutetium PSMA and then an equivalence in overall survival. So with that data in mind and then the VISION trial also in mind, it can guide us for how we can use lutetium. So in my current practice, day-to-day practice, let's say February 2024, what I do is it's not possible to offer this to patients that have not received any taxane chemotherapy in any setting. It's not reimbursed in the pre-taxane situation. So they have to have received one or more than one novel hormone therapies and at least one taxane chemotherapy that could have been in the hormone sensitive or the castration resistant setting. And then I do a PSMA PET scan. And what I'm looking for, Neil, is I'm looking for a lot, you know, abundant and high uptake PSMA expression. So both abundant and high uptake. And then I'm looking for the absence of visceral metastases that are not producing PSMA. And in particular, what we have learned from our experience, including myself, is if you have liver metastases, which are PSMA negative, and you have 10 really hot PSMA positive bone metastases, that patient is probably not ideal for lutetium PSMA because yes, while the bone metastases could be controlled, the liver metastases will explode. And that's one thing that has changed for me as I've gained more experience with this. Initially, I was so infatuated by the option that any patient who had even the slightest degree of PSMA uptake, no matter how much PSA negative disease they had, I would recommend it. And now I'm a little bit more careful. I like to see either predominant or exclusive PSMA positive disease with the absence of PSMA negative disease. And also, there are some cases, Neil, where there is no visceral disease, it's only bone disease, but the PSMA uptake is very faint. You might have an SUV value of 3 or 4 or 5 rather than 50. So that means a much, you know, lower uptake. And for those patients, I also hesitate and I will discuss with them the alternative, which is cabazitaxel. And of course, we should not forget about radium-223. So if I have a patient with bone only or bone predominant disease and the PSMA uptake is lukewarm or faint, then I may recommend radium-223 for that patient.
Any comment on the prevention or management of xerostomia with lutetium?
You know, I have not found any effective prevention strategy. So some people have talked about, you know, icing the salivary glands during the treatment. I have not personally found through my patients' experiences that this has helped. There are, of course, salivary supplements, just drinking more water more often, brushing teeth more often, sucking on candy, lemon drops, mints, spicy things that produce saliva. Those behavioral things, I think, are more important than any pharmacological or icing of the salivary glands, in my experience.
One final question. Of course, we've seen the combination of cabozantinib plus atezolizumab as in a phase 3 study just presented at the ASCO GU meeting compared to second novel hormonal therapy with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer reported. And they are reporting an improvement in PFS, hazard rate of 0.65. Any thoughts about this data? I guess the survival hazard is, you know, premature, but 0.79 at this point. Any thoughts about this combination?
You know, the phase 2 study that led up to this was compelling, and I think it justified a phase 3. There's an unequivocal progression-free survival benefit. I don't think anybody would contest that. The thing that is contested, including by me, is that we had a study called the COMET 1 trial. Matthew Smith was the PI, published in JCO. COMET 1 trial, post-AR therapy, post-chemotherapy, cabozantinib alone versus placebo. Cabozantinib had a clinically significant and a statistically significant PFS benefit without an OS benefit that was not sufficient to get cabozantinib approved. And here we're seeing a PFS benefit also to the same degree in terms of the hazard ratio. So the question in everyone's minds and lips at the ASCO GU meeting was, is the atezolizumab adding anything? And I spoke to many investigators at the meeting and they shared my sentiment, which is that I'm not convinced myself that the atezo is adding anything. Having said that, I reserve the right to change my mind if the overall survival is positive.
All right, well, we'll see. It'd be great to see checkpoint inhibitors finally get in there other than MSI-high, but we'll see. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Anton Arrakis, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.